Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Anne Ball, Alice Bryant, and Jill Robbins. Later, Dan Friedel will tell us what's trending today, and Katie Weaver will bring us this week's personal technology report. But first, here is John Russell.
Educators in Turkey are at the center of a government campaign against Kurdish rebels. More than 12,000 teachers have been suspended for suspected ties to the Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK. The campaign has affected schools in Diyarbakir, a city with a large Kurdish population. Almost one-fourth of its 17,000 teachers are suspended. The teachers are accused of supporting terrorism because they took part in a strike last year. The strikers called for an end to fighting between the PKK and the Turkish government. Saliha Zorlu is a leader of Diyarbakir's Educators Union. She says that she believes there is a larger plan behind the government's crackdown. Her union, she explains, supports secularism in education and in Turkish society in general. Secularism is the belief that religion should not have a strong influence in education or other public parts of society. If the union is not active, she says, the education system will change into a religious one. We are already seeing signs of this today, Zorlu adds. During the attack on us, we saw that imams were appointed to state-run dormitories. Dormitories are the buildings where students live. Traditionally, Kurds in Turkey are religious conservatives. Religious groups that support the government have recently increased their activities in Kurdish areas. These activities include supporting calls for the region's return to its Islamic roots. Religious activities are seen as an opposition to the secular PKK. Like the rest of Turkey, there has been an expansion of religious schooling in the Kurdish region. The government insists that the teachers' suspensions are about fighting terrorism. The head of the ruling AKP party in Diyarbakir, Muhammad Akar, said, "In the upcoming days, those who made propaganda for the terror organization, who boycotted schools, and who encouraged students to join the terrorists, will be separated from the innocent teachers." He added, "I can say that a significant percentage will be reinstated to their duties, and the others, those who are guilty, will be charged." The arrests and suspensions of teachers are continuing to fuel anger and protests. Idris Balukin, a parliamentary group leader of the pro-Kurdish party HDP, warns the suspensions are increasing tensions in the area. The conflict between Turkey and the PKK appears to have a new front line, education. Children and teachers seem likely to be caught in the crossfire. I'm John Russell.
Mike Pence is the Republican Party's vice presidential nominee. He is the governor of the Midwestern state of Indiana. He is a very different person from Donald Trump, the party's presidential nominee.
People who know me well know I'm a pretty basic guy. I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order.
In the 1990s, Pence hosted a radio talk show. At that time, he spoke to Randy Declean about his hopes for the future and for government service. Declean praised Pence's message.
The overarching message of what he had to say was very, very positive and upbeat and inspiring.
Paul Ryan is a Republican and the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. He said Pence believes strongly in his faith and conservatism.
He's a man of faith. He's a man of conviction. He's a man you can trust. He comes from the heart of the conservative movement and from the heart of America.
Pence failed the first two times he tried to win a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was successful on his third attempt in 2000. He says he does not believe government should try to solve all problems.
We're tired of being told that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives better for us than we can plan them for ourselves.
In 2012, Pence left the U.S. House and became governor of his state. He dealt with difficult issues such as abortion and the conflict between gay rights and religious freedom. Pence's conservative beliefs and voting record bring balance to the Republican Party ticket. He does not support all of Trump's positions. Gary Nordlinger teaches at George Washington University.
The conservative branch of the party, who's been suspicious of Donald Trump, know that they can trust Pence. So if Trump is elected, I think Pence can be of great value in terms of dealing with members of Congress on behalf of the administration.
Pence would then have the hard task of serving as a bridge between the administration and Congress. I'm Ann Ball.
A growing number of people are using computer software and other technology to support the needs of immigrants worldwide. Many of these people already work in the technology industry. Some observers are calling this new movement digital humanitarianism. Over the past 2 years, VOA and other media have been reporting on the immigration crisis in Europe. Many of these immigrants are coming from the Middle East and Africa. They are looking for safety and a better quality of life. Some of the immigrants are migrants, but many others are refugees. Migrants go from one place to another for economic reasons. Refugees flee violence or political unrest in their home country and seek asylum. The United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, reports that about 65 million people were displaced at the end of 2015. Since last year, many software developers have been creating digital solutions to help countries deal with the growing number of immigrants. Technology is changing every part of the journey of refugees and migrants. Before going overseas, for example, they need to plan their trip. During their travels, they might need to send signals for help. After finally arriving in their new country, there are a long list of needs, such as housing, health care, jobs, and legal help. Last month, the Migration Policy Institute released a report on these digital tools and how governments can better support their development and use. The report is called Digital Humanitarianism: How Tech Entrepreneurs Are Supporting Refugee Integration. It says the 2015-16 period was impressive for the expansion of these digital tools. The report says that, although the movement has shown promise, it needs more financing, better organization, and inclusion in policy talks with governments.
Since 2015, computer programmers have launched a number of digital tools designed to help refugees. For example, an app called InfoAid is for individuals and families traveling through Southeast Europe. It provides information about national borders and transportation, and advice on security, among other things. Another tool, Trace the Face, can help immigrants reunite with loved ones by posting images and searching for photographs online. The website is a service of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Yet the report also found that a number of good ideas from this flood of high-tech development have resulted in wasted energy. It said that too many teams were working separately and creating tools that perform similar tasks. Megan Benton, the lead writer of the report, is a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. She talked about the mistakes tech humanitarians were making.
So one of the challenges I point to in my report is the fact that there have been hundreds of apps developed that try and be the default, the one app to help people access services when they get to a new city. And I think that we're finding with some emerging evidence that refugees would prefer often to use existing platforms like Facebook or WhatsApp, or just to have government websites that are easier to understand.
A number of these apps are no longer operational. The report adds that the technology industry is learning from its mistakes. It is moving away from the "let's create an app" model, Benton notes, and finding better ways to serve refugee communities. Many programmers are now attempting to organize themselves through a nonprofit group called TechFugees, the report says. The group coordinates conferences and projects among its 15,000 members in 14 countries, including the United States. TechFugees supports user-centered design, which Benton believes is important. User-centered design is about listening directly to what refugees say their needs are, and then designing high-tech tools based on these needs. TechFugees also plans to use its expertise to help non-governmental organizations or NGOs such as the UNHCR with their tech needs.
The report says government officials and lawmakers only recently have learned about some of these inventions. So, while the tech community might be going in the right direction, governments are not yet sure how to make use of their efforts. The report calls on governments to identify the needs of refugees, invite the tech community to join policy talks, and help finance the best inventions. For example, when governments need solutions, such as ways to make housing available to refugees, they sometimes offer prizes for good ideas. The European Commission and the Swedish government already offer challenge prizes. Benton says government agencies need to do more of this.
But is technology a realistic solution for every refugee need? Jobs and the wages they provide are a continuing issue. The report says governments and many NGOs have mostly overlooked new refugees' need for credit. Refugees usually have problems opening bank accounts. The report suggests crowdfunding and peer-to-peer lending as another way to help the new arrivals. While jobs are the best way to earn money, most refugees cannot work legally in their new home until they are offered asylum. Megan Benton notes that when the asylum offer finally arrives, the refugees are often housed in rural areas, far from the best positions. For now, technology can help reduce costs for job training and education. More importantly, the training can take place on a computer and sometimes a telephone, anywhere. Some software tools connect highly skilled refugees with employers, such as Work Here in Germany. Other programs offer education at no cost. There is also a serious effort to offer free coding classes to refugees so they can start careers in computer programming. Two examples are Reboot Camp in Jordan's Zaatari refugee camp and Refugees on Rails in Germany. Benton admits that more attention must be paid to refugees with lower-level skills. She says they could get help from a website like Amazon Mechanical Turk, which advertises many kinds of small jobs. The site is a division of the American online business, Amazon.com. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
This is What's Trending Today. Many people have heard the story of Scotland's Loch Ness Monster. Yet, have you ever heard of an ice monster in the American state of Alaska? Well, an ice monster is what many people thought they were seeing when a federal government agency published a strange-looking video. The Bureau of Land Management put the video on its Facebook page. The pictures were taken in Fairbanks, a city in north-central Alaska. While winter has yet to officially begin, weather conditions in Fairbanks already are very cold. In the video, a fish with ice on its back appears to be swimming in the Chena River. The video was only 20 seconds long, but it was enough to get people wondering what they saw. One person said he thought it showed a shark that lost its way. Someone else wrote that he thought the video was a prank designed to trick people. The writer said the Bureau of Land Management wanted to bring attention to its Facebook page. A number of media organizations picked up on the ice monster story and talked about it on their shows. Other writers asked if the video was edited in some way, removing some images or adding others. Some readers said it was ice moving in the river current, or ice that was frozen to a rope or some other object. On October 31st, the Bureau of Land Management published an update. An expert from the Department of Fish and Game told the Bureau the picture looked really cool, but it was probably just ice stuck to a rope. Even though the mystery seems to be solved, some people do not seem persuaded. And that's what's trending today. I'm Dan Friedel.
Last week, the future of computers came more clearly into view. Microsoft and Apple announced new machines that demonstrate where computer technology is headed. Both big companies are trying to innovate with these computers, offering new features. These features may become usual in future machines, or they may prove unpopular and soon be forgotten. The new Microsoft and Apple computers are very different from each other, but they appear to be on the same path. Both computers use touch technology in unique ways. Both have new login methods, and both are very thin. They are also similar in that they are priced high. Today, Brian Lynn and I tell you about each. Surface Studio is Microsoft's first desktop computer. It combines elements of the Microsoft Surface tablet line with the features of a traditional computer. The Studio comes with a 28-inch touchscreen monitor that moves on hinges from vertical to nearly horizontal. You can type using the included Bluetooth keyboard, or move the screen to horizontal studio mode and use it as you would a piece of paper. The Studio comes with a stylus called the Surface Pen, so you can draw on the screen, take handwritten notes, and sign documents. Logging into the Studio is easier with Windows Hello that uses a camera to identify you. The Studio is designed to work especially well for those in the creative fields. They can use its flat, horizontal surface to design, draw, and write. The screen can also turn to be used as a traditional monitor for those who want to type and use a mouse. Surface Studio pricing begins at just under $3,000. Microsoft also announced last week an accessory called Dial. Rest the silver disc on the studio surface screen and turn it to choose colors, menu options, and more. Dial also works to rotate images on the screen and as a back button to return to an earlier version of a document. You can use Dial to control volume, to scroll, to zoom, and to adjust the brightness of the screen.
Apple introduced a new MacBook Pro last week. It is the first major update to this line of laptops in many years. The biggest innovation of the new MacBook Pro is the touch bar that replaces the keyboard's function keys. The touch bar is a thin touch screen with function changes depending on what you are doing on the computer. Software can be programmed to make the touch bar have menu options, slider controls, emoji icons, and more. In Safari, you can use touch bar to access open tabs or to quickly visit favorite bookmarks. Touch bar also brings Touch ID to the MacBook Pro. It lets users use their fingerprints to log into the computer, like the Touch ID on iPhones and iPads. Touch ID can also be used with Apple Pay on the computer to pay for items on websites. The app 1Password uses Touch Bar with Touch ID to let you use your fingerprint as a password for websites. Port changes are major in the MacBook Pro. It has 4 USB-C Thunderbolt 3 ports that connect both device and power cords. This permits speedier data and power transfer as fast as 40 gigabytes per second. But USB-C, a newer model, could require an adapter to connect your devices. For example, the lightning cord that comes with iPhones and iPads needs an adapter to plug in to the new MacBook Pro. Gone is the MagSafe connector, a magnetic port that let the power cord disconnect easily from the computer. Instead, the power cord connects to any one of the 4 USB-C ports. The traditional headphone jack is the only other port on the MacBook Pro. This port is not found on iPhone 7 and 7 Plus. This means that Apple's Apple Lightning earbuds that come with those phones are incompatible with the new MacBook Pro. The MacBook Pro is available in 2 sizes, beginning at just under $1,500. The Touch Bar runs about $200 more. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.